Welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club Technical Question and Answer Net. My name is Roy. My call sign is AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host. Bob KD2NVB will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages, and we also offer original articles and reviews on many of the topics that are also covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder, and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts, tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange color type, but if you'd like a simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com, and we also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to the node KC2RC-R. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, and all of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only. If they have questions or comments for this net, please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the TechNet or you can email us. The email address is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Good evening, everybody out there. Hope there's some folks out there looking forward to a nice net tonight. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. We will find out any moment whether there's anyone out there listening to us. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net. If there's anyone out there with any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit that push to talk and say hello.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike Delta Victor.
Eugene recognized. What's your question for tonight, Eugene?
Good evening, Roy, and everybody on the net. Actually, no, I don't have a question. I just wanted to give a follow-up on that battery issue that I have with the lithium iron phosphate. So I tried to drain it, and it was interesting because I had the voltmeter on it, and I was putting, I think it was a 9-watt bulb, 12 volts, and it would just drop to zero, so basically it would not take any current. And as soon as I removed the bulb, it goes back to 1.2 volts, I think it was, or 1.3, and that's pretty much it. So as soon as I tried to discharge it, it would give no discharge, and it would remain at 1.3, and it's still standing like this. So that battery is just, nothing can be done with it, really. Back to you, Roy.
Oh, well, it was worth a try. I've been reading up on lithium iron phosphates. They reportedly, not in my experience, but reportedly, they do have a tendency at times to develop, as they self-discharge, develop a fine iron needles that short out individual cells, and then they become incapable of taking a recharge. Although, you know, that's a lot of cells to simultaneously fail. So it might have been some kind of inherent flaw in that batch of lithium iron phosphate. Did you contact the manufacturer, and did they respond in any way, shape, or form?
No, I haven't contacted the manufacturer. I think it had a 2-year warranty, and it's 3 years. So no, I didn't even write or anything. But another research that I did, you know, just to kind of see if there's any other options, it looks like it could have been the BMS, the battery management system, because sometimes if that goes bad, that could cause the battery to basically malfunction. So that's, yeah. I mean, I purchased the other one, which is 16 amp hours, and it was roughly $65, I think. This one's performing well, and I'll just keep an eye on it. You know, give it a charge every now and then to make sure nothing like this happens.
Okay, I wish you good luck with that. Yeah, like most rechargeable batteries, it's not a good idea to go through deep discharge cycles. So it's always good to kind of top it off. I mean, theoretically, there's a lot of wacky stuff in the literature of, you know, what's the best level to keep rechargeable batteries at. Doesn't seem to be that 100% is the best. There are some articles that suggest 60%, 70%, 80%. I can never backtrack those articles to any kind of actual experimentation with results. They seem to be anecdotal, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, I think recently Apple, I think with the iPhone 15, they included the ability to limit the charge. You could limit it to something like 85% instead of 100%. I know you can do that with Lenovo laptops, because I do that with my Lenovo laptops. So I've gotten into the habit of not fully charging my rechargeable batteries. We'll see what happens. I mean, unfortunately, my iPhones are not capable of limited recharge. I leave them on the recharge thing. And as I may have mentioned previously, my iPhone 6 Plus is bulging, and I just ordered a replacement battery from MyFixit. I think this is going to be the second or third replacement battery I put into that iPhone 6.
Really interesting that you mentioned this, because on my Galaxy phone, I've discovered probably about a month ago, actually it's been a little more than that, there's a battery protect feature, and it limits the charge to 85%. So it wouldn't charge past 85, and they say that, you know, prolongs the life of the battery. And with my recent update, that was roughly 2 days ago, it reduced it to 80 with the new update. So I guess they changed the threshold, so now it limits to 80%. So I guess it's working since they're doing it.
Yeah, I think Apple had a previous history of doing it without telling anyone, and when the customers found out, they sued, class action, and got some lawyers, you know, a second summer house or something. But I think they had done it in the past, and the premise that everyone thought was that they were just ruining the iPhone and making it less useful so that you'll, you know, upgrade to the latest, greatest model, and their side of the argument was, no, we're trying to spare your battery from a complete failure as you know, its life slowly goes under. And so I guess it's a different thing when they kind of tell you up front, as opposed to, we're not doing anything with your battery. It's just, you know, maybe you would like a new iPhone, 23X or something. That maybe that'll be your solution. It only costs $15,000. You know, you can take a loan out. So I think that's good, as long as you don't kind of burn out the battery through the day, and I never have. So, it's just easier for me to leave it on the charging stand, even though I've had a lot of expanding batteries in my life as far as iPhones. And one Microsoft laptop suffered the same fate right after the warranty expired.
Because the point of the lawsuit was like false advertising. So let's say they were claiming that their batteries are 5,000 milliamp hours, and since they were charging them not fully, I guess they were really getting 4,200 or 4,000 milliamp hours. So that was kind of, what people got upset about.
Yeah, it might have been that. It might have been, you know, I mean, Apple's a very paternalistic type of company, so, you know, they know what's best for us. I mean, their whole thing is curated environments. And but the problem is with consumers is you have to let them know. Back in the bad old days in medicine in the 60s, medicine was very paternalistic. And doctors treated patients and their family like small children. So if someone was dying of cancer, sometimes they didn't bother to tell the family. They just patted them on the back and said, it'll be all right, you know, until it wasn't. So those days are gone, because those guys started to get sued a lot. And so you have to fess up with people. So paternalistic approach to patients or customers is not a good idea.
That is true. Well, thank you so much for your advice, Roy. And I'll stay with this battery. And actually, some people say it's good to discharge roughly 50%, maybe 30%, but never like going down all the way. So yeah, I'll try to do 50 or 40 at the most and just recharging. And obviously if I'm leaving it for a long time, like off season and such, I'll just keep an eye on it every, I guess, couple of months, because it shouldn't be, according to manufacturer, shouldn't be losing more than 2% of charge per month. So, you know, leaving it out for 10 months shouldn't deplete it more than 20%, which is roughly a year. So every 6 months sounds to be reasonable, just to keep an eye on it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The only problem, as I see it, is I don't know about your chargers. None of my chargers really tell me their capacity, you know, until they're fully charged. Then they tell me it's charged. They do that with algorithms based upon voltage drops according to charge percentages. But again, I don't know about your charge devices. Do they give you a percentage of charge indicator in it?
Actually, yes. The charger that I have is a 4-amp charger, and it has 4 bars. So when I hook up the battery, it will light up either 1, 2, 3, or 4 bars, depending on the current charge status. So when I received this battery, it was almost full. It displayed 3 bars, and the 4th bar was blinking, and it only took about 10 minutes, if not less, to basically top it off, because the starting voltage was, when I received it, was 13.2, I guess, so it was nearly full, and that's what the charger showed. So, yeah, I'm pretty well covered in that. At least I can see the capacity.
Okay, very good, very good. Yeah, I think one of the many problems Apple had was they played games with the firmware so that the percentage charge indicator misread. So when they were really charging up to about 85%, the indicator would register as 100%. So it was a bunch of these little passive-aggressive things that Apple decided to do to its customer base that got it into trouble back then. Okay, very good. I wish you luck with your new battery. Like I said before, I have 2 lithium iron phosphates. I haven't used them a heck of a lot, but when I have, they work fine. So good luck, Eugene.
Thanks so much, Roy. We'll talk to you soon. KD2MDB.
Okie doke. This is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussion tonight, please hit that push to talk and introduce yourself.
K2ZZ.
Hello, William. How are you tonight?
Yeah.
William, is there anything I can do for you tonight?
I was up on the roof looking at the antenna, and it seemed like, you know, with the way I've got it set up, with the way there's 3 poles up there, I could put up 2 or 3 or 4 more different versions of, like, long line antennas and different manufacturer center fed antennas and stuff pretty much on the same posts, even though, you know, I could have maybe room for 1 at the top and then like 2 or 3 underneath it relatively close by, and then have a switch down here. So I could try testing out different kinds of antennas. And I was wondering if you thought they'd interfere with each other or what the issues might be with playing games like that.
Well, I wouldn't suggest that you transmit on more than 1 antenna at a time, or that you have a receiver hooked up to 1 while you transmit out of another at the same time. But, you know, as long as you have a switch that only selects for 1 of those antennas. Now, you know, pieces of wire in the near field might slightly detune the antenna, but most antennas really should be kind of tweaked when they're in place. So as long as the wires aren't very close and you're willing to adjust for resonances, you shouldn't have any particular problem having more than 1 antenna on your roof.
Basically, the way I look at it, these things would be connected with strings on the ends back to the poles and stuff, and they would be within inches of one another. I would think I'd have a selector switch to choose which one was going on, you know, but on the air, but it would be interesting to, you know, listen to have run the script or something on the 10-meter net and click back and forth between the different antennas and how the stream sounds and stuff to see if anything works. So I'm thinking maybe NFED would be a fun way to go with a 66 feet. What do you think about that?
NFEDs are fine. They're not the most efficient because you inevitably are going to need some significant balance to transform the impedance. And depending upon the design of the balun, they do kind of take a percentage of the power out of your line. So center feds are very efficient if you like them, if you have room for them. But you could try an end fed in addition to a center fed. I would have at least one center fed out there.
Well, the center fed is there, which is why there's three poles. And now I'm thinking about, you know, how to see if it's any good or overbuild it or which antenna is better, and then maybe get a 5/8 vertical like you have.
Yeah, you could do that too. You could put the 5/8 at the top of your the pole that's supporting the center position, and that's, you know, that's a vertical, so the horizontal orientation of your other wire antennas aren't going to interact much with it at all. And if you want to try an end fed, you know, try it at a different position. You know, don't have the end fed be parallel with the center fed unless you have no choice in the matter. You know, just to add a little bit more variety to your options.
I see what you're saying. Well, parallel is the easiest option so far, and then I suppose some sort of diagonal deal would be better. So the question, how much wind loading do you think is on the top of the post that would be holding the 5/8 antenna? Like you have this, yours is like 15, 16 feet long, right?
Yeah, but yeah, it's not very heavy. It doesn't have a lot of surface area. Most my 5/8, the most of the surface area is at the base, where there's a you know, a loading coil type of impedance matching setup. Otherwise, it's a very thin, flexible piece of metal. Shouldn't be a problem. It's never given me any kind of problem. Whereas, unfortunately, I've had a lot of problem with my other antennas. I can't imagine. Just the 5/8 vertical alone, probably 60 mile an hour winds probably won't cause it too much problems. The mast that's holding it up might. So the wind loading on the mast that's supporting it at whatever elevation you're going to put it might have an effect. But those are relatively small, sturdy antennas. I like I said, I've never had any particular problem with the wind affecting them much. They kind of just blow in the wind.
Did you copy that?
No, I did not.
AC2ZV, did you copy that?
All I hear is when you say this is AC2ZV, did you copy that? I didn't hear anything before that.
This is WJ2NF clock not set coming from the transmitter. It's probably a transmitter override from the feed that you're getting over Echolink or something, but it was that that thing that announced that the clock's not set on the repeater.
I don't exactly know how that could happen, because, you know, I'm hooked up to the Echolink, I'm hooked up to the radio. Hey, it didn't receive any signal.
Awesome, it just goes into my radio only. I'm special. Well, we'll get into this later, but I think it's something to do with the repeater. Do you hear the call sign DDDDD stuff going on also during the transmissions on your recordings?
Yeah, I hear the call signs.
Often the repeater keys in the Kings County Radio Club, you know, little announcement. I think that's really cool and gives it Morse code. So I think that's a really cool thing about the repeater.
Well, I mean, that's how repeaters work. You're supposed to ID. You can either do it with a voice, or you can do it with Morse code, or you can do it with both. It's a setting on the controller that plugs into the repeater. So it's an FCC requirement. So if you didn't do that, you'd be in violation of FCC rules, Part 97.
Hey, thanks for answering all my questions about these antennas. I think the thing is that I tried at one point to put up a really big pipe and for ham radio rig, and it got vetoed. And so now I've got to figure out, maybe I got to change out the pipe that's supporting the existing TV antenna, and then, you know, have a better mount for the 5/8. So I think that's a good plan for me, because what I've got for the wires is not strong enough to handle that.
Okay. I can't speak for you in your environment. My 5/8 doesn't really have that high elevation. It's on my roof, so it's about 25 feet off of the ground, and the mass is about 6 feet. So, you know, it doesn't require a lot of elevation. I have a co-op apartment complex across the street. Doesn't seem to be bothering it. There's Trump co-ops to the west, I think, of me. So you don't quite need enormous elevation for the 5/8 wave vertical. Just kind of get it away from anything obviously really nearby that might be blocking it, and you should be good.
And then if I'm co-polarized, I'll get another dB or so out of the signal, so I think that'll be good too. So that would give me a little bit more gain from what I've got.
Yeah, you never know until you try. I mean, I used to enjoy the idea of having both a vertical and a horizontal. You know, sometimes the vertical worked better, sometimes the horizontal worked better. And I've told this story before, and I'm sure I'll end up telling it again and again and again. It was this a couple of guys in Florida where ordinarily I would perceive it as a fade. They would fade in and out and in and out. But when I had both antennas connected to either ear, I could hear that it wasn't really fading in and out. It was rotating, so it would show up on my right ear, which was the vertical, and then the left ear, which was the horizontal, and then back in the right ear again. And Faraday rotation was just rotating its polarization angle in the ionosphere and changing it. So, you know, that was nice to have available.
I think it's lucky that you were able to have stereo and experience that in stereo. That's kind of an amazing feat. But one of the things that we found out was that a lot of radio waves are reflected as circular polarized anyway, so they get jumbled up by the ionosphere and they come back circular polarized. So the fact is it's switching, you know, left and right is like the circular speed, and it just it's like the waves when you look at the ocean is like blue little little.
Yeah, the ionosphere can do interesting things. I mean, unfortunately, you know, people kind of take the theory very seriously. So their attitude is, well, you know, I read someplace where, you know, if you have a vertically oriented antenna and the other guy has a horizontally oriented antenna, you're going to have a massive amount of signal attenuation just because of the cosine of 90 degrees is zero. So, but the problem is that the things don't work theoretically. They work practically. And so, you know, you can get away with the wrong angle polarization for some situations, but not others. So, you know, it's very nice having that additional variable so that in the old days, I could just, if I heard a person better on the vertical, I'd switch over to the vertical. If I thought, if they sounded better horizontal, most of the times I would just do the diversity reception that I just mentioned. And I get two different signals in each ear. So I would just favor the ear that the signal sounded better on.
Two radios to do this? Or there's two demods in the flex?
Yeah, there's two demodulators. There's two tuners in the flex. My 6700 has two hardware transmitter receivers. And the software can simulate three additional virtual receivers on each tuner. So four, I guess. So I can have four different transmissions tracked on the HF bands, or I can move them over to UH or VH.
A real fun radio. I suppose once I get less active with what I'm doing, I'll get a fancy radio because I think having a fancy radio would be a lot more fun.
It depends upon the individual. Some people like keeping it simple, saving money. Other people like buttons and dials. If you like buttons and dials, you really wouldn't like my 6700. It has about six buttons and a small little display where it can show a couple of texts. But that's about it. It all basically uses a computer surface controls. So I run it on the computer in the shack. The Flex Radio just announced their new 8000 line. My radio, the 6700, it was the top of the 6000 line. So they announced the 8000 line. They discontinued my model, the 6700. They haven't announced an 8000 series version of it. So it's the new models they announced were the 8600 and the 8400. The 8400 has one tuner and can produce, I think, two virtual receivers, and the 8600 has two tuners, and it can produce virtually four radio receivers.
Sounds like the 6700 is the workhorse, and they don't want to keep making it.
Well, I don't know what the situation is. I went to the forums, and I'm already reading people complaining that that their 6700 is better than the new 8000 series as far as they're concerned. You know, at this point, they weren't given a lot of specifications, but they were doing things like, well, the field programmable gate arrays are twice as fast, and the CPU is four times as fast. What does that mean? If you don't change the firmware, which they didn't announce new firmware, you could only do the same things you could do with the old SDR radios. So it sort of depends upon what they do in the future. If they bring out firmware that has features that are so amazing that you need faster processors. At this point, it just sounds like, you know, they just wanted to refresh the line, but we'll see.
That's great. Great chatting with you, Roy. I wonder if anybody else out there has any technical questions. I got a couple of guys last night that seemed like they might be interested. Maybe they're out there listening.
Okay. Well, we're certainly open for business, William. I'll throw out a call once again. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month, starting at 9 o'clock, going for as long as anyone has any questions or needs some help. So if there's anyone out there who has any comments or questions, please hit that push to talk.
D2WOT. Good evening. Just saying hello. No questions at this particular moment.
Okay, Chris, good to hear you. I'm curious, did you hear any kind of signal from JNF that William heard recently, about 10 minutes ago?
I'm sorry, Roy, a signal from what?
William said he heard a signal from WA2JNF on his radio, although I didn't hear it on the radio. I didn't hear it on the Echo Link. I was just curious if you had heard it.
Oh, I've been listening probably about 5 minutes. I hadn't heard anything. I did hear just before during William's transmission, it sounded like a lot of noise in the background for some reason.
Oh, okay. Yeah, what apparently happened is he was trying to talk, and I couldn't hear him on the radio. I didn't hear any signal, and then after whatever was interfering with his radio, then I was able to hear him. So he kind of locked up his radio, apparently, and didn't let him transmit. So, okay, it'll remain a mystery. Anyway, thanks for coming by and saying hello. You know, the last month or so, it's been real slow here, real quiet.
Yes, I guess there was a few announcements at Hamfest.
Did you hear anything interesting? I don't actually kind of Google it insanely, but I mean, I wander through YouTube and other such things. The problem, as I lamented this Sunday night, is, you know, for a group of guys who are interested in communications, we don't make terribly good communicators when it comes to, you know, advertising and promoting events. Because it's very difficult. I couldn't find anything. I'm expecting eventually I'm going to end up seeing a couple of YouTubes of a bunch of guys wandering around with a cell phone, and they'll shake it around. They'll point it at the floor. They'll put their thumb on the microphone so the audio will be muffled. So I've never really found an enjoyable source for hamvention news on YouTube. They really tend to be amateurish for some strange reason.
True. I was watching the other day. It's an older gentleman. I forget the call sign. Apparently from I think out from Washington State. outdoor area was pretty rainy, I think, so it was a little bit muted, but it looked like a good crowd anyway.
Okay, that's good to hear. I mean, again, unfortunately, most of the time when I see videos of amateur radio conventions, there seems to be a large number of morbidly obese guys sitting in motorized wheelchairs, which is not a terribly good look for us. There was a guy that I used to be friendly with. He was another physician who was also an amateur radio operator for years and years and years, and he just kind of disappeared off the repeater in about 7-8 months later. I bumped into him on the air, and I asked him, anything bad happened? And he said, no, I went to a ham convention, and I looked around, and everyone looked very unhealthy, and I decided I should join a gym and spend my time doing other things. So, you know, I mean, we have an interesting demographics, amateur radio operators, that doesn't really help us out a lot. But, you know, we'll see what happens. I'll give a little bit more time for the dust to settle, and then I'll do a couple of YouTube searches and see if I can find anything interesting. But it's sort of a shame, you know, everything else, you know, comes through emails to me, but you sort of think the ARRL would kind of send a little something, but they don't. So, okay, we'll see.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, this, you know, it is an older demographic, you know, as you say, and there's some changes, I mean, going on. Of course, MFJ is going out of business, and then I saw a YouTube recently where a place in Ohio, I guess it's called Fair Radio, they're going out of business. Everything's going to be auctioned off. Man, they have some warehouse full of stuff. I mean, stuff going back to World War II. Crazy stuff. So, back to you.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's the nature of the hobby. I think a couple of weeks ago, I got into a discussion with someone else who has an expert systems linear amplifier. It's manufactured in Italy, so that company is, as far as I'm aware, doing well. But their United States distributor has been very problematic. The first guy who started importing them in and repairing them died. Then he was taken over by his family, who didn't know anything about ham radio. It was taken over by the guy who used to fix the linear amplifiers. Then he kind of lost the distributorship to, I think, the guy that who bought up the license for the bug Morse code keys. And now it's moved from that guy to a retailer, Main Trading or something. They're now listed as a distributor. So, you know, a lot of these companies are one-man companies. Palstar, I think, has maybe 10 employees. MFJ, we talked about. My lovely little watt meter, my LP500, is one guy, basically does all the stuff, which unfortunately kind of limits innovation. You know, he's so busy building the parts and shipping them out that he can't be bothered to fix the firmware and make it a bit better than it is. So, and you know, if he ever retires, then that watt meter is gone. So, you know, again, it's the problems. You know, no one, I think, ever got rich off of retailing ham radio stuff. It's kind of a job that you just have to love the community in order to do it.
Absolutely.
Yep, well, we'll see how these things work out. You never know. Someone might invent something really nifty that will revolutionize our hobby. It won't be artificial intelligence, and I'm sure it's not going to be M17, because I'm deeply confused. I don't know if you or anyone else out there is familiar with M17. It's an open-source digital voice protocol, which is sort of a solution to a problem I don't know if anyone has, but you know, they're working on it, and I think Kinect Systems have become affiliated. Those are the guys that ship over Chinese radios and such, so they're going to try and build a radio that includes M17 in the protocols. So we'll see.
Yeah, I saw a little bit YouTube's again. You know, 17. And then also that the Meshtastic seems to be a hot little thing. It's just a like a whole network of little transmitters that relay in a mesh, basically. And so, you know, the ability to communicate over a wide distance is accomplished by, you know, hopping from node to node to node to node, if you will.
Yeah, I've been keeping an eye on Meshtastic. It's much more popular and useful on the West Coast because the West Coast has a significantly higher density of amateur radio operators. And for Meshtastic to be functional, you have to get a certain density of activity. You can't have two guys or three guys spread out to, you know, two counties or something. You need to kind of have a cluster of transceivers in order to develop a mesh, and the more individuals that are part of it, the stronger the mesh becomes. So, you know, it's kind of like if Meshtastic was anything like ATV. You know, there's in a good year, there's about two or three people in, say, 60-mile radius who might be interested in doing ATV. That's not enough for a Meshtastic. So I don't know of anyone who's really doing it heavy duty on the East Coast. I know a bunch of people on the West Coast, though.
Well, you know, it's very low-cost hardware. I mean, you know, $30-$35, something like that. It's UHF, and it's, you know, very low power. So, you know, so it's got to be, as you say, within a very limited distance and, you know, a heavy saturation of units placed around.
Yeah. It's just I don't think you could probably convince enough guys in the metropolitan area to put up enough cells to make it work. There was a variation on the theme a couple years ago. Limark had Operation Green Sky when they were having a particularly bad jamming problem. And what they did was they had a bunch of club members scattered throughout Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island and ran it with these USB SDR devices and linked it to computers. And so you could go up on a web page and it would track the signal strength and whether it lit up that location. So, you know, the strong signals kind of gave you an indication where the jammer was coming from approximately. So that was nice, but unfortunately, like all things, the dongles started to fail. The people who volunteered kind of got apathetic, and it sort of faded away.
Well, interesting. I guess maybe it the jammers went away, I guess, or just about. I haven't heard much jamming.
Well, yeah, I don't think they caught anyone, but, you know, I don't have a direct line to the president and the vice president of Limark. These things kind of come in cycles. I have heard old-time jammers show up on Limark. Thankfully, they just don't have the same people to jam. In the old days, they would jam Hal, they would jam Richie. There was a whole people kind of asking to be jammed, practically. And those people have shuffled off this mortal coil. So it's a lot less. Although they're still out there, if you listen to good old the technical net, when poor Wesley comes on, there's still some guy out there trying to jam him.
Yeah, that's... I think that's true. I mean, it looks also as though we may have some microphone difficulties from time to time.
Yeah, he has two problems. When you hear him when you hear him with very, very low amplitude, that's his microphone problems. Or when the audio just kind of disappears, that's a microphone problem. But you also will hear either a kind of pink noise in the background, kind of equal amplitude, and then other times it's just kind of a noisy output that I don't know where this guy pulls the audio from. So it's a little bit of both, unfortunately, for Wes.
Yeah, well, so, you know, some people just don't have a life, and they get their jollies, you know, doing something like that.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I mean, generally the advice that everyone gives each other is to make believe they're not there. I try to do that. Occasionally, I will just offer my opinion that it's a shame that a person has nothing better to do with their lives than just jam some stranger that they don't really know. It doesn't make any difference in their own lives. And hopefully that gives them something to think about.
True. Well, it's always worth a shot. All right, I'll stand by for a moment in case anyone else wants to get in there. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We meet here at 9 p.m. on the second and fourth Wednesday of each and every month. And so we're here tonight. We have a TechNet puzzle. We'll get to it soon, I think. But if there's anyone who has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, please hit the push to talk and give us your name and your call sign. Okay, nothing much heard. I kind of suspected. Let's do the TechNet puzzle. We kind of tabled it for the last two TechNets because it was kind of me and Bob and Bob and me. And so, you know, I wanted to wait until there was a somewhat bigger audience. So the TechNet puzzle for tonight, there's no pictures. I'll just read it to you. What is the main reason for a switch mode power supply to operate internally at a frequency well above 60 hertz? And you got four choices. A is to provide a much faster switch on rather than waiting for the capacitors to charge. B is to allow a digital control system to be used providing enhanced control features. C is to allow a much smaller and lighter transformer to be used. And D is to minimize the risk of unwanted radiation into the equipment or main supplies. So does anyone wish to hazard a guess of which is the best answer, A, B, C, or D?
I believe the answer is C, KD2WOT.
Yes, indeed, Chris. You are absolutely positively right. The benefit of a switching power supply is by increasing the frequency past 60 hertz, often into the kilohertz range, is you require a less and less efficient transformer, which reads into less wire windings, less ferrite material, and it makes it lighter, it makes it cheaper, and it makes it more efficient. The downside is by going for the higher frequency, you're left with those spurious signals that you then have to filter. So you require a significantly better smoothing, filtering output stage than you do when you're using a linear amplifier that's just going on the 60 hertz of the utility line. So that's the reason. There are a lot of old-timers out there that if you mention switch mode power supply, they'll spit on the ground. They'll tell you horror stories of where they plugged it into an oscilloscope and showed people all the damn noise that it was cranking out. But I mean, you know, those were 20, 30 years ago. Filters have gotten a lot better. Manufacturers have gotten a lot better. All of my power supplies here on the shack are switching power supplies. I did get a wall wart that was a linear wall wart because the manufacturer suggested I do it for a problem. That problem wasn't solved with a linear switch wall wart. But the wall wart that was linear was at least 2 to 3 times heavier than my switch wall warts. And so, you know, it was a wonderful little indication of the differences between switching and linear. So I thank you, Chris. Anyone with comments about that, feel free to hit that push to talk.
To NVP with a question.
Certainly, Bob.
I don't know why. Why is it that the frequency going higher means you don't need as efficient an amplifier, right? Or is it transformer? Anyway, yeah, I don't understand why.
Yeah, the higher the frequency, the less efficient the need for the transformer, because the transformer operates on magnetic field at lower cycles. You get a lot more artifact. You get a lot of eddy currents produced, so you have to isolate each individual layer a little bit better. It requires a much more highly inductive transformer to get the same power transfer at lower and lower frequencies.
Okay, I won't ask why that is, but I kind of get it, so that's good enough. So anyway, thanks.
You're welcome. Anyone else with any questions for tonight? Okay, we'll give it one last try. I mean, it is 9:57, so it's almost time for probably putting the technical net to sleep tonight. But we'll give it one more try out there. Anyone with any questions or comments before we call it a night? Very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each and every month. Our next meeting will be June 5th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, with some form of identification for the required link. Although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 8:30, 9:30, 10 o'clock, depending upon the number of points that need to be covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m., and we also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband or nearby. We offer an audio stream of our KC2RC repeater on the internet as well as our 10-meter net. Just type into your browser stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. And it's time to roll this all up and shut it down for now. We'll be back again June 12th, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, especially my co-host, Bob KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy AC2GS. I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Everyone stay safe, be well, and we'll talk to you down the line. This is AC2GS Clear.